From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American industry got a running start in the early 1800s by stealing England's most valuable industrial secrets. Now, China and other fast-growing countries are picking America's intellectual pockets, says Pat Choate, 1996 running mate of presidential contender Ross Perot. The giant sucking sound now, he says, is the sound of ideas being stolen away in a globalized economy. The U.S., says Choate, loses hundreds of billions of dollars annually because of international piracy and inadequate policing. We are witnessing, he says, a global crime of immense proportions. Every stolen DVD, software package, industrial design, and Kate Spade handbag knockoff hurts the U.S. economy. America must fight back with better policing, Choate says, or accept that it will fall behind. Tonight on Point, the global battle over intellectual property and the future of the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation. Can we, should we, build better walls around America's ideas? Is the U.S. economy doomed to struggle if we can't stop the theft of the fruits of American innovation? Or in the age of globalization, does the U.S. simply have to innovate faster than competitors can steal? Is that possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Diego, California, is Pat Choate, political economist and author in 1990 of Agents of Influence, Warning of Japanese Lobbying Muscle in Washington. With Ross Perot, he wrote Save Your Job, Save Our Country, Why NAFTA Must Be Stopped Now, and was Perot's vice presidential running mate in 1996. His new book is Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization. Good evening and welcome, Pat Choate.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's good being with you.
It's wonderful to have you. There's some great history in here. We want to hear some of it before we dive in to all the details of what's going on right now. But give us your big thesis first, if you would, Pat. What's the problem here? We thought information was flowing in all kinds of directions these days, and that was a good thing.
It is flowing, and much of it is a good thing, indeed. My basic thesis is that one of the ways that nations develop is stealing the technology of others. We stole technology from Great Britain. Germany stole technology from Great Britain in the last part of the 19th century, built their enormously successful chemical industries. Japan stole technology from Europe and the United States in the 20th century, and now China is following the rather traditional pace mm-hmm. of taking technology from around the world. They have added some new wrinkles to how the technology is stolen, but they're taking that technology at a very fast pace, as are countries such as Russia and Brazil and others.
China in particular, do they deserve to be singled out, or is it just because they're the biggest player?
Well, they're the biggest player. They're establishing the most modern manufacturing base. They're the largest threat, but certainly they're not the only threat. Each year, the United States Trade Representative presents something called a Special 301 report. In this last year, the USTR identified 63 countries that are not providing adequate protection for U.S. and other foreign intellectual properties. Again, the point I make is this is not a moral issue. This is how countries develop. And because we develop that way, we should be very knowledgeable about that, know our own history, know the history of others, and then protect ourselves accordingly.
Pat, I wish you'd take us back to some of that American history, because though I knew it in outline, I was still struck by some of the details and the audacity of it, how essentially in the 19th century, the U.S. Had a policy of saying to its citizens, go out and steal everything you can. We'll protect you once you bring it home, but we won't protect anyone else. Good luck to them. This is our industrial policy. Have I generally got that?
I must say, I was struck as well. It was fun researching this book and the early part of our history. Basically, what happened is the United States, when it declared its independence, found that it lacked all the means necessary to produce the arms and the tools of war that it needed to defend itself. A frightened U.S. Congress in 1776 had to send Benjamin Franklin to France to get the essentials of war, he had to buy blankets and shirts and muskets and gunpowder, had to ship them across the Atlantic into the Caribbean, past the British blockade, transfer the goods to smugglers, get them inside the United States. Well, after the war was over, the leaders of that war who manned the U.S. government, beginning with the president, George Washington, absolutely determined that this country, to remain free, had to be industrially self-sufficient, particularly in the tools of war. So they did several things. The first thing that they did to encourage domestic development, they put into the Constitution Article 1, Section 8, which gives to inventors and authors the exclusive right to the use of their creations for a period of time that will be set by Congress. They, in effect, created a golden covenant in exchange for giving up the knowledge of how they create something. The inventors got the exclusive use of it, and originally that exclusive use was for a 14-year period.
But the U.S. government had no problem if that American innovator or entrepreneur went out and stole it from another country. In fact, that was practically encouraged.
More than that. They encouraged it. They absolutely encouraged it. You had state governments that were offering bounties to bring in European and foreign technology. At the same time, the patent laws of the United States between the first act in 1790 and the third major act in 1836 particularly excluded foreigners. It did not give patents to foreigners. And in during that almost 46-year period of time, not a single patent was issued to a foreigner unless they absolutely committed to stay inside the United States and become a citizen.
So when we look with shock at what's going on in China today, you're reminding us this is a well-trod path to industrial development. I wish you'd tell us one story here. Some of our listeners will know it, others won't, of 1810, 35-year-old Francis Cabot Lowell, a Boston entrepreneur.
Wonderful story.
please share it with us, Pat.
Francis Cabot Lowell came from a very distinguished Boston family. He was a Harvard graduate. He was a merchant shipper. He brought in enormous amounts of goods from England and Europe for the United States. And he determined that he was going to steal the greatest industrial prize that England possessed. That was the secret of how to make the power loom. Earlier, a man named Samuel Slater had come to the United States with the secret of the automated spinning wheel.
So to make cotton into thread.
That's right. So we knew how to make the thread. And we knew how to make that in enormous quantities. We did not know how to automate the production. He went to England, and he went to England, took his family, took his children, under the claim that he was sick and that he was taking a tour for his health. Now, Manchester, England would not automatically be a place that one would think you would go for your health.
For a spa treatment.
For a spa treatment. He rented a large, luxurious carriage, stayed at the best hotels, and he would contact the owners of the various textile mills, and noting that he would be in the neighborhood, would wish to come by and visit. Would it be possible for them to show him the mills? They all did. They would never do this for any of their competitors or anyone else. They couldn't imagine that a pedigreed Bostonian would ever think about stealing anything. But it turns out that Francis Cabot Lowell had an eidetic memory. And each night he would write down precisely what he saw. And then when he left for England, coming back to the United States, he was searched, as all people who were leaving England were searched at that time for the technological plans. No one knows how he got it out. Came back to the United States, built a model in what is now Lowell, Massachusetts. The model turned out to be better than the original, formed the first corporation in America called the Boston Manufacturing Company, and soon built an integrated mill that would take wool and cotton in one end and would have cloth coming out the other. He was soon producing the equivalent of one-third of a mile of cloth a year. It was an immediate and an enormous success.
And as you describe it, Pat Choate, essentially kicked off the real heart of the Industrial Revolution, or brought it to the United States. Without that, who knows how long it might have taken. So you're pointing us to this dynamic scene again and again, that grabbing and stealing is very often integral to countries' development. Is that not going to happen inevitably today as well?
Yes, it is happening today as well. The thing that a country, a developed country, a Europe, a Japan, a United States must do is find ways and means to defend themselves, to not be cavalier about this, not saying that it's that you can't stop it. You can slow it.
Is the U.S. being cavalier right now, today? Are we letting valuable intellectual property slip away carelessly?
We're totally indifferent. We're absolutely totally indifferent. We invested an enormous amount of energy in the 1990s to create innovative solutions, and we won't use them. One of those innovative solutions was we led the world in the creating of something called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property System at the World Trade Organization. It's a global treaty. 148 members have agreed to the provisions of that treaty that they will provide minimal standards, and they've also agreed that if they don't provide minimal standards, that other countries can go to the WTO, take it before a neutral panel. If the panel agrees they're not providing those standards, then they can impose fines. Those fines can be collected by tariffs on imports into the country.
And that's not happening, you say, Pat. We're going to come back and find out why. Pat Choate is with us. His new book is Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? If 19th century America built its fortune on stolen intellectual property, is 21st century China wrong to try to do the same? And are you worried that you're buying counterfeit products, ripped-off designs and technology, or is a rock-bottom price your bottom line? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the global battle over intellectual property and the future of the U.S. economy. My guest tonight, Pat Choate, joins us from San Diego, former running mate of Ross Perot in 1996. His new book is Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization. We're going to have a couple more perspectives joining us in the course of this hour, quite soon. But you can join us as well. Can we, should we, build higher walls around American ideas, around American intellectual property? Should we enforce the walls, the laws, the rules that we already have? Or in a globalized information age, does the United States simply have to innovate faster than competitors can steal? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pat, I wanted to get a sense, a more explicit sense, if you'd share it with us, of the kind of products, if that's an embracing enough word, that you see being stolen, being lost right now. What are we talking about here?
Well, we're seeing medicines that are being stolen. We're seeing auto parts. We're seeing aircraft parts. We're seeing machine tools. China is counterfeiting an entire line of General Motors automobiles. They're counterfeiting a car. Quite literally, virtually anything that you can think of that can be manufactured is being duplicated, pirated. Other people are taking the benefits.
And you're saying
in many cases, they're exact duplicates and they'll perform the same way. In many other cases, such as in the medicines, they are phonies. They have no medicinal value. One of the major reasons for the high rate of malaria in Africa today is that counterfeiters are selling phony placebos as real drugs.
And how much of the loss to the U.S. economy that's going on now do you argue, Pat Choate, could be staunched with more vigorous enforcement of existing laws?
The FBI estimates $200 billion to $250 billion a year is the cost to the United States, a significant amount of that can be reduced. Today, we're really doing nothing on this. We will make a token effort at the Customs Bureau, at the World Trade Organization, where we created substantial rights. In fact, we traded off 1 million jobs in the apparel and textile industry to get the developing world to accept the TRIPS agreement. The Bush administration has not filed a single case in 5 years. The Clinton administration filed 13 cases in the late 90s and won 13 cases. This administration is reluctant, in fact, has refused to file any of those cases. Moreover, since 2001, the FBI agents that were engaged in economic counter-espionage have been transferred to the war on terrorism. Quite literally, we're doing virtually nothing today to deal with this problem domestically or worldwide.
Pat Choate is with us from San Diego tonight. His new book is Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization. Joining us now in the studio here in Boston is Josh Lerner. He's professor of investment banking at Harvard Business School, author of Innovation and Its Discontents, How Our Broken Patent System is Endangering Innovation and Progress and What to Do About It. He's director of Innovation Policy and the Economy Group at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Josh Lerner, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So here's Pat Choate, who has raised alarms before that have turned out to be reasonable alarms, mm-hmm. raising a real big alarm about intellectual property, about everything from design to ripped off pharmaceuticals, he describes here, auto parts, airline parts, you name it, being duplicated and sent back from China. Do you agree with his description of the scale of the problem? And do you agree with Pat Choate's prescription that we've just got to go in and be much, much tougher on enforcement? Can that staunch the flow, Josh?
Well, I think at one level, I very much agree with Pat's diagnosis that there are real issues. But at the same time, I'm very worried about the cure that he offers. I think to look at why I'm worried about it, we can just go back in time to the 1980s. And during the early 1980s, a lot of the same worries were being expressed. But they were about theft of intellectual property, about key assets being purchased at low prices. But it wasn't China we were worried about. It was Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember there were the books, the Japan is Number One. There was...
Sure, Ezra Vogel's book.
Right.
And Pat's own
right.
book, Agents of Influence, about Japanese
right.
influence in Washington.
And we had Rising Sun, where...
Mm-hmm. The movie, Michael Crichton's
right.
Book and movie.
Exactly. And in a lot of ways... Again, the diagnosis may have been fair, but what happened as a result of it was really problematic. We ended up, as a reaction to that, saying, well, what we need to do is have more protection of intellectual property, and the way we're going to do that is to have stronger patents. And what we did is we sort of created the super court, this court of appeals for the Federal Circuit, which handles patent cases, which has become, you know, sort of almost from the beginning, very pro-patent in their orientation.
Stronger patents sound like a solution. Why not?
Well, it's had all sorts of unintended and quite perverse consequences, where we've seen basically the creation of a whole new industry, which is basically set up to litigate patents. We've seen an explosion in patent litigation, patent filing, and in many cases, innovative firms now have to really deal with two sets of competitors. There's the real competitors who are out there in the product market mm-hmm. who are selling things, and then there's the paper competitors who are basically in the process of filing patents and doing lawsuits and getting, in many cases, very, very problematic patents, yet being very successful.
I'm not sure I understand that second line of competitor. So I create some innovation, I patent it, and then what happens from this second-tier challenger? Not a real competitor, but a paper competitor.
But you can, just like anyone else, if you have a patent, you can basically go to court, and you have this presumption of validity with you. And particularly if you go in front of a jury, it's what's to stop you from...
So you're saying a challenger just sort of hokies up a patent, a similar patent, and challenges the one I've just legitimately filed.
I had lunch with a CEO, who I'll leave nameless, last Friday, who was basically fighting a patent case. In fact, he's already lost some of the early rounds of it. And his opponent is essentially someone who in his earlier life had been an auto thief and basically now has turned to patent litigation as an alternative line of work.
Pat Choate, join us here. Is it possible that the medicine, the cure may be worse than the illness here, that in trying to nail down intellectual property, you end up sort of nailing the world down in a way that doesn't work?
No, I don't think so. As I point out through the book, what the founding fathers did is they established a right, the right to an exclusive use. And then what they did was they provided the means. They allowed people to go to federal court and sue. When we break down the numbers on the patent suits, what we find is I'm convinced that it's not that really large of a problem. We find, for example, inside the U.S. that less than about 1% of the patents are contested. When you get down into the numbers, then something like only 25% of that number actually goes to a trial, and you go to the next level of it, 75% of those actually settle. So we will wind up with maybe 2,000 patent cases a year. And in the cases that come up, the patent survives, the patent owner wins. Something like 60% of the time they take it to the appellate court, and about two-thirds of the time the patent will be upheld. This is a rigorous salmon swim here for an inventor. They, first of all, only two-thirds of the patents are approved. A third of the patents are rejected at the patent office. Secondly, then you have the testifier through a patent examiner, an expert. Then you go to the next level of a trial where you must assume that each side is going to have very competent and aggressive counsel.
Right.
And then you go to the next level, an appellate court in Washington. As Josh says, it's the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Federal District. These are people who are experts in patent and other matters. And if a patent, if this number of patents survive over that, it's basically a tested system.
Okay, I feel a bit like Babe in the Woods here, but you all know the details of this so much more deeply than I. But first, on this point, Josh, about whether or not the portion of patents filed that's challenged, effectively challenged, is so small that this isn't really such a big problem. Let me ask you about that.
Well, I think a lot of cases we can, the analogy I like to use is that we're seeing the tip of an iceberg. And basically, the sort of fear of litigation can have a huge impact on people's behavior, even if we're not seeing court cases in many cases.
You mean they don't innovate in the first place? They don't create the next light bulb because they're afraid they couldn't defend it?
Or else they get a letter which is threatening them with some sort of judgment, and they basically decide to write a check rather than fight it out in court because they know the odds are stacked against them.
So I can hear you two are going to disagree over the effect. We won't solve that tonight, but let me ask you, given that disagreement, what are you suggesting as an alternative, Josh? If it's not stronger patent protection, and we know if another country doesn't honor the patent, that doesn't help in the first place. But if it's not that, just at that level, what are you suggesting? A more Wild West, open, less patent protection system?
Well, I think we need to have much more of a careful review process. I disagree a little bit with Pat's characterization that only around two-thirds of the patents are approved, simply because the patent office cleverly counts things that are rejected but then refiled as rejections. So when you actually count all the ones where people come back a second and third time, it ends up being more on the order of 90 or 95% of the patents which are filed ultimately issuing. And a lot of the problem is that these examiners are working under lots of time pressure, and they don't have a lot of resources. And as a result, there's a lot of stuff issues that really should never have issued in the first place. So having much more in terms of an opportunity for people to step into the process and basically say, look, Mr. Patent Examiner or Ms. Patent Examiner, you don't know where to look, but here's something that you really ought to consider before you grant that patent. That would be a big first step. But I think that also addressing the litigation process is also very important as well.
Pat Choate, you and Josh Linner are beyond us on the detail on the patent front. But let me ask you, you're suggesting that patents are only going to go so far in any case in protecting these national assets, if you look at it from 30,000 feet here, that the Chinese manufacturer won't respect the patent anyway in many cases.
That's
so
right.
So how much
That's
of
right.
the solution is at the patent office?
Well, a good part is at the patent office. You've got to issue good patents, and you've got to issue them in a timely manner. One of the points that we haven't discussed is one of the difficulties that we have today is we haven't kept pace in hiring enough patent examiners inside the United States. And so on average, the pendency, in other words, the time from you when an inventor files to the time an inventor gets a patent, is now around 27.6 months. It'll probably move up to 30 months this year. We have a backlog of 500,000 patents in the warehouse. We need to have enough patent examiners so that we can move those patents out on a timely basis, like 5 or 6 months. So that's a big thing that we can do domestically. But internationally, we should use the provisions of the TRIPS agreement that we've created. We should demand of other governments that they provide the minimal protections and the judicial procedures that they have agreed to do and that they have benefited from by the elimination of quotas in textile apparels. In other words, a country such as China will soon have 30 million people employed in apparel and textiles, and they'll probably take 75% of the U.S. market. They're gaining an enormous benefit in this trade of textiles for IP protection, intellectual property.
And if they don't deliver it, you're saying under that system, slap down tariffs, that would be really wounding to China.
Go to the WTO. It's not simply us. It's the Europeans, it's the Japanese, it's creative people everywhere. Go to the World Trade Organization, get a finding, in other words, make our case, and then do a realistic assessment of the damages, which I think could be $20, $30 billion a year. Get approval of the world community to impose tariffs on the Chinese, and then, in effect, collect that. What will happen when we do that is Japan and Europe will follow us very quickly on that. If we make it hurt to steal, then the Chinese government will aggressively deal with the problem.
Pat, Josh, stand by. I want to begin to welcome our callers in. Jason is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to start off by saying that while I do agree with Pat that we do need more patent examiners, I think that's a big part of the problem. I think another part of the problem also is the overly broad nature of patents and copyright as well. I think that one of the problems that we're running into is you end up with ideas that are obvious, that are not useful or unique, that are being patented, and you end up with basically just a glut of patents that, as Josh said, ends up scaring other innovators out of the market.
This kind of patent mania, patenting everything in sight. But what about the things that really are technological crown jewels? Don't they need protection, Jason?
Well, I think they do need protection, but I think that protection already exists, and the idea of slapping excessive tariffs on countries that may steal our intellectual property is basically saying that, sorry, you're too late to the game. You're not allowed to innovate and to achieve the same level of industrialization that the Western world has achieved.
But I realize Pat pointed it out. That's what the United States did for nearly a century. But why shouldn't China do the work to innovate beyond what some American innovator has produced rather than just copy it?
How has England suffered from the U.S. stealing patents and intellectual property 200 years ago?
Well, they were number one, and now they're number what? I don't know, 21.
They're tourist location.
I think that the most important thing to do was, if they do steal our ideas, then that definitely forces us to have to innovate harder, innovate faster, and come up with better ideas.
Jason, it's a provocative line, and I'm glad you bring it in. Josh Lerner, how about it? Is it a kind of a trade-off between enforcement and a more open system where we win by innovating even more quickly? Is that a reasonable, workable, system?
Well, I think that when you look at what the heart of the American system is today, it really is one where we have essentially very distributed innovation. It's not an IBM or an AT&T who is doing all the innovation in the industry.
Or a Japan where the Ministry of Trade is kind of directing innovation.
Instead, we've got industries where there are hundreds of innovative firms who are basically all coming up with ideas, where they're trying to jockey for position in standard-setting organizations and just create and work out a real vision of the future.
And if they can't own and profit from that for at least a few years, if it's off to China just as quick as an email, then does the system break down?
Well, I think that certainly one can worry about spillovers and the sort of ability of people to capture these things. But at the same time, there's a real danger that the cure will be much worse than the disease, that we'll end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater if we clamp down in such a way that we basically don't allow this very dynamic, distributed system of innovation to continue to work.
Pat, we've just got a minute before the break, but what do you say to that? We hear all the time about how the flow of American ideas and innovation is so important. Would your prescription bring a kind of, rigor mortis in here?
No, do just the opposite. 45% of all patents are issued to small entities. Those are firms under 500 people, universities, and individual inventors. They absolutely need a patent if they're going to get financing and if they're going to protect themselves against large predators. If we weaken the patent system, we'll weaken innovation by that segment of the economy.
Pat Choate, author of the new book, Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization, and Josh Lerner, professor of investment banking at Harvard Business School. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about the global battle over intellectual property and the future of the U.S. economy. You can join us if 19th century America, as Pat Choate says, built its fortune on stolen intellectual property, is 21st century China wrong to try to do the same? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the global battle over intellectual property and the implications of how it goes for the future of the U.S. economy. My guest tonight, Pat Choate, joins us from San Diego. He's author of the new book, Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization. Josh Lerner is with us in the studio tonight, professor at Harvard Business School, author of Innovation and Its Discontents. You can join us as well. What do you think? Can America be a cauldron of innovation and do a better job of protecting its new products and ideas? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined right now from Vienna, Virginia, by Jeffrey Cushion. He's a partner at the law firm Sidley Austin Brown & Wood. He advises companies and trade associations on international patent policy. For 2 years, he served in the office of the U.S. Trade Rep in Geneva, represented the United States on intellectual property matters before the World Trade Organization. Jeffrey Cushion, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hello.
So we're hearing a couple of different perspectives on the best way of going about protecting American intellectual property, whether to really toughen up on enforcement, go after China and others hammer and tongs when they are seen to be stealing intellectual property, or whether that's impossible and kind of gums up the system and leads to slowing down of an economy that's supposed to work quickly and ideas that are supposed to travel quickly. What's your perspective? Are we failing to protect American assets on the intellectual property front or not?
Well, in each country, particularly in China, that has emerged over the past 15, 20 years, they've had to come to appreciate how IP works in their native environment. And one of the challenges has been sorting out how to use IP in a way that's productive for both the domestic interests and also for the American interests coming in and trying to do business in that economy.
Pat Choate says essentially they're just, going all out using any way they like.
Well, it depends also on the type of intellectual property. And if you look at copyright and trademark protected goods, copying of those goods is such a simple equation. It's zero-sum games in some sense.
So, for example, software is just all over the place. DVDs, American movies.
Right. There's very little defensive posture an entity who's copying those products has as to why they copied it. They're trying to use exactly the IP that is embodied in that work. And when you go into the patent area in innovation, it's sometimes very clear that something's been copied and knocked off directly, and other times patents cover more diffuse ideas that are, harder to show that it's really a derivation versus a slavish copying.
Are you arguing then that China, and that is a universe encompassed in that word, is acting responsibly, is reasonably around intellectual property of that latter kind, the kind that it needs to also innovate? Or, Pat's saying, look, we're being taken to the cleaners as China builds its industrial capacity.
Well, in the patent area, it's a little bit more complicated. If you look at what's happened in China, the first wave of effort went into, writing the laws, and on large part, China's laws do reflect a fairly modern perspective on patents. The next phase of development has been, you know, just the process of getting patents issued. You know, having an idea or having a patent application has no value. You've got to get the Chinese government to actually grant you a patent. And in that second phase, they're doing an okay job, but not necessarily a great job. The third phase is when you have your patent rights, you know, using them to prevent the unauthorized use of a patented invention. Mm-hmm. That's the ball, you know, that you're actually shooting for. And in that setting, there hasn't been a lot of success. There have been efforts by China to create the court systems and the procedures, but you know, when it comes down to it, we have not heard a lot of companies having great success in using the patents to prevent the unauthorized use of their technology.
Pat Choate points out that the Bush administration has barely gone after instances of that kind of abuse. Why not, Jeffrey Cushing?
Well, as I said, it's a more difficult challenge in the patent area than it is in the other areas because, you know, it's not always clear that you're infringing a patent. The patent rights can be narrow or broad, and you've got to sort out in a court fight whether or not you've got infringement. So it may just be a matter of, you know, another 2 to 5 years seeing whether the courts are actually stepping up and shutting down the unauthorized use of the patented invention.
Makes it sound like it's easy to steal, but hard to follow up on that theft. Time-consuming and, I imagine, expensive as well. Jeffrey Cushing in Vienna, Virginia, at Sidley, Austin, Brown & Wood. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure.
Our time is short. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Jason is calling from New York City. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, listening to the conversation and, you know, wondering, aside from sort of the legalistic point or the moral issue of whether stealing is right or wrong, but from a broad, you know, perspective, if countries overseas are sort of our biggest problem with them is their labor costs are so much lower than ours are, you know, isn't it kind of to our benefit that they improve their living standard and industrialization to sort of even out that balance, regardless of whether, you know, some of our companies may get hurt in the short run?
Ooh, interesting. So you want to make a ratio here. You're saying, go ahead, China, steal some of this and get more affluent quickly so you don't compete on low wages for American jobs. Pat Choate, what do you say to that?
Well, we'll never be able to compete with China on the basis of wages, given the size of their population. If we do that, we're in a race to the bottom. But I would approach it from a slightly different way from the caller's perspective. One of the reasons that we've opened our market to the Chinese and have pitted our workers against penny wage labor in China is so that they will develop a market economy. The basis of a market economy is the concept of property and the concept of a contract and the concept of private rights and the concept of the private means to enforce those rights. If we are indifferent to the concept of intellectual property, of ideas having an exclusive use by the creative people, the Chinese will not respect that. And if we're indifferent when we make a treaty with the Chinese, a contract as it were, and they can openly flout that and we're indifferent and do not try to enforce the contract, then why should they? And how do we expect a country, a communist nation, where the concept of private rights is an alien concept and the private means, such as through the courts to enforce that, is antithetical to the very foundation of their system? It seems to me that we are really upon a very frustrating errand here. But if we're really serious, if we're truly serious about getting China to go to a market economy, then we must insist that property, private property, be respected and that contracts be respected and that private rights to enforce and the means of enforcement be provided.
If that doesn't happen, large scale, what do you think the consequences will be for China, for the U.S.?
Well, I mean, basically at that point, then we go back from a rules-based economy to a managed trade relationship. I'm not saying don't do trade with China. I'm saying do trade in such a way that we do not subordinate our interests or undermine our creative people. We can have trade with China. We can simply do it on a managed trade basis, and that is done throughout the world.
And that would be the end of that kind of vision of global free trade. Josh Lerner, is there any historical precedent for disciplining a competitor nation on the scale that Pat Choate is describing here? I mean, is it an imaginable task to say, to take China, vast, sprawling as it is, and say, you're not going to do things this way anymore. We're going to discipline you with these fines and consequences if you do. We look at, imagine the United States as it looked at the at Great Britain 100, 200 years ago. How you would have contained all that crazy energy, I don't know. Could it be done with China?
Well, I think that in some sense you can argue, yes, China is unique. But on the other hand, we have seen certainly many situations before where we've had emerging nations which have chosen to play by their own rules, which have been convenient for them.
Mm.
But I think what we've typically seen is one where people's perspective changes over time. So we take, for instance, the rule of law. I think that there's today a tremendous amount of literature which suggests that ultimately, growth very much depends on the workings of an efficient court system and so forth. So I think it would be very surprising to look at China, just as China has changed in the last 10 years, it would be very surprising to look at China 10 years from now and see the same level of a court. So I think we're going to see much more development in that area, not so much because of outside pressure, but because simply it's strategically a good decision on their parts to encourage further development.
So you're offering a kind of encouragement to Pat, saying don't be so despairing about this. China is likely to, in the natural course of things, become more closely observant of how private property is treated, including intellectual property?
Well, I think it's in their self-interest in many respects. I think that they look, for instance, at the U.S. and look, for instance, at the venture capital industry and see this as something that's immensely desirable, as something that they very much want to encourage. And I think certainly in terms of the various conversations I've had with people there, there's been a sort of increasing understanding of policymakers that one isn't going to get that kind of investment without having some degree of a real legal system to operate under.
Pat Choate, what about it, that this problem may in some respect be self-limiting, that with its own economic evolution, China will come around to tougher, more normal judicial oversight of patents and intellectual property quite naturally?
Well, of course, democracy and a market economy would be very good for China and the Chinese people, but it would be very bad for the communists who run that country. The very idea of private rights, the very idea of private means, the idea of liberty for the people runs totally contrary to the communist system.
But there's an awful lot of liberty that's obvious. You just step into China, you can't miss it, and there's a lot of private property functioning all over the place, right?
Oh, that's right. They have certain degrees of that, but it's really the nomenclature there. It's that upper leadership. It's really the communist leaders, the favored few, the sons, daughters, etc. But there is there's also the question of why should an American property owner accept the idea that for 10 years or so they must wait for China to respect their property, that in between time that it should be stolen, when the United States has a treaty with China that says that they will not do it, and the United States has the means to go to the WTO and seek a remedy that will, in effect, compensate them for that. As far as the example of a country dealing with this responsibly, the Europeans filed suit against us about 5 years ago for our foreign sales corporation, got a judgment of $4 billion a year, which they began to collect, and the United States changed our laws to deal with that. What I'm saying, a $20 or $30 billion fine annually on China will force them to deal seriously with the problem and to respect our property.
That would get a lot of heads turning, maybe spinning.
It'll get their attention.
Yeah. I wonder if we'll ever see it. But, Pat Choate, you put up a big flare, and we're looking at it tonight. Thanks for illuminating the scene below, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me, and thanks, Josh, for his comments.
Pat Choate, author of Hot Property, The Stealing of Ideas in an Age of Globalization, and Josh Lerner, professor of investment banking, Harvard Business School, author of Innovation and Its Disconnects. Wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for being with us, Josh.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, paying tribute to the Tour de France. This is On Point. Lance Armstrong wrapped up his record 7th straight Tour de France victory yesterday, finishing a comfortable 4 minutes and 40 seconds ahead of his nearest challenger. Today, Armstrong said he will never again ride in the Tour, which is widely considered one of the toughest competitions in all of sports. North Carolina rider Dana Hay was one of many Tour de France fans impressed by Armstrong's victory. His win reminded her of a passage written by novelist Kay Boyle nearly 7 decades ago.
In her 1938 novel, Monday Night, Kay Boyle tells of a woman whose son has just won the Tour de France. She is the owner-proprietor of a bistro and, in French custom, sits with her patrons, Americans, Milt and Bernie, as well as a member of the Garde Champêtre, similar to a deputy sheriff in the U.S. Milt has been a working journalist in France for 20 years. Bernie is a newly arrived student, mesmerized by the mother's voice as she speaks of her son and the grueling race. Reading about Lance Armstrong's remarkable victory yesterday reminded me of a passage in Kay Boyle's novel Monday Night. Kay Boyle tells us what the Tour de France means. In French custom, her character, Milt, refers to winning the Tour de France as winning the maillot jaune, the jersey yellow, the adjective jaune, yellow, following the French noun maillot. Now, the passage goes like this. I know guys who'd rather have the maillot jaune than the Nobel Prize if you gave them the choice, Wilt said to Bernie. But Bernie was looking on at the woman and listening to her voice going on, so that in the end, the Tour de France was no longer composed of a knot of men in striped sweatshirts pedaling, or a string of men along a roadside pumping with bare, sinewy legs, the mud-stained shorts they wore clasping hairy and sweat-drenched and rain-drenched thighs. Even the Garde Champêtre forgets the impersonality, the Adam's apples jerking for breath in the throat, the flat, raw wrists set near the handlebars and violently inflamed with sun, the skulls too animal narrow to contain anything beyond instinct or a racial memory of what other men's muscles had endured before. The body's grotesquely deformed by a male prodigiousness which began where the torso terminated and strapped the legs with a brutality tough enough to pedal them over 5 passes, 5 or 6 times higher than the Eiffel Tower and hotter than the desert. It was no longer a battalion of flat-chested, warp-shouldered men as callous as jockeys in their vernacular and as gaudily dressed, whose photographs held the center of the sports pages and who wheeled slowly or savagely through the newsreels in every movie theater in France. But as she talked of them, they became a legend of the young and the exalted, as vulnerable as poets, recruits to an intrepid company that strove with only honor or at the most achievement, the reward, as well as the goal. The money in it might have been something they did not think of until after, for she talked of them not as one would talk of bicycle racers or even as athletes, but as if they were part explorers seeking another strata of atmosphere or sea, part knights defending an even purer conception of the Holy Grail.
North Carolina writer Dana Hay, reading from Kay Boyle's 1938 novel, Monday Night. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.